Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, for years, veterans claiming to suffer from Gulf War syndrome were derided as cranky and hysterical by the Department of Defense and even by some journalists. Will that change now that a definitive report says the Gulf War illnesses are real, incurable, and caused by toxic materials used by the U.S. military during the 1991 Gulf War? We'll talk to Paul Sullivan, a Gulf War veteran and the executive director of Veterans for Common Sense. Also on the show, as the Obama White House takes shape, Americans are asking what the president-elect's cabinet choices suggest about the political direction his administration may take. Corporate media are making no effort to hide what they think are smart, responsible choices for Obama, but the reasons for their strong preferences are rarely explored. We'll talk with FAIR's Peter Hart about the press reception of the new cabinet picks. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
One of the most obvious and depressing examples of corporate media's anti-democratic bias is the way they encourage politicians to break promises to voters and suggest that this shows leadership or maturity. Who cares what you told voters? Here's what the interests that really matter want you to do. The latest example in this sad series is a USA Today editorial from December 2nd that spots a silver lining in the economic crisis. Quote, "During his campaign, Obama endorsed a number of smaller bore ideas, more for the sake of their political appeal than for their economic usefulness. The financial crisis gives the incoming president a compelling rationale to make a few modest course corrections," close quote. The paper then offers three of its own modest proposals for how Obama should best rewrite his platform in a more big business-friendly direction. One is to drop the idea of a windfall profits tax on the oil industry, because windfall profits taxes, the paper says, quote, aren't a very reliable or stable source of revenue, close quote. An odd objection given that windfall profits are by definition sudden and unexpected. The paper would also have Obama drop the idea of renegotiating NAFTA, claiming that outside a handful of heavily unionized states, NAFTA isn't seen as a bad thing. That's just flat wrong, according to numerous national polls. And finally, the editorial turns reality on its head again to argue that Obama should abandon his longstanding support of card check union certification, saying, quote, "It is hard to see how ending the secret ballot would do much besides initiating campaigns of subtle and not so subtle intimidation as workers contemplate their decisions," close quote. But as those familiar with the issue understand, it is the current system which treats organizing as a matter to be contested with the employer rather than decided by the workers themselves that allows those employers to intimidate workers in ways that are not subtle at all. One recent study based on National Labor Relations Board data found that as many as 1 in 5 union organizers are illegally fired during the course of a typical union certification campaign. Yet for USA Today, for Obama to support changing the system would, and see if you can follow this, quote, "position Obama less as an agent of change and more as a pal of big labor," close quote. See how they did that? Changing things shows you're not really an agent of change if the thing you want to change is something corporations like.
Well, as the press try to figure out the political direction of the incoming Obama administration, two newspapers took up the issue of health care with troubling results. In the Los Angeles Times on December 1st, under the headline "Consensus Emerging on Universal Health Care," readers were told there's opportunity for real change, up to a point. The Times puts it pretty clearly near the top, quote, "The idea of a federal single-payer system patterned on those in Europe and Canada, long a dream of the political left, is now virtually off the table," close quote. One would reach that conclusion by talking to the folks quoted by the Times, two people from industry trade groups, a Heritage Foundation analyst, and a Republican senator, along with two liberals who stressed the need for consensus. Almost as an afterthought, the Times noted that, quote, "advocates for a single-payer system, including the California Nurses Association, have vowed to continue pushing the idea next year, along with many Democrats on Capitol Hill," close quote. On November 30th, the Washington Post was reaching similar conclusions by speaking to a similarly narrow range of sources. The Post article is blunt in its declaration that the U.S. healthcare system is inefficient and wasteful. But the people offering solutions are mostly industry representatives. Where are the critics of the big insurance companies or advocates for single payer? Just like in the L.A. Times, they are not part of the solution.
George Bush lied again about the run-up to the Iraq War, this time in a December 1st interview with Charles Gibson of ABC News. And again, the media missed the story. When Gibson asked Bush whether he had regrets or wished he had do-overs on Iraq, Bush told Gibson his biggest regret was that the intelligence had been wrong. When asked if war would have ensued if the intelligence had accurately shown no WMD, Bush said, quote, "Yes, because Saddam Hussein was unwilling to let the inspectors go in to determine whether or not the UN resolutions were being upheld. In other words, if he had had weapons of mass destruction, would there have been a war? Absolutely." Close quote. Seeing that Bush misunderstood his question, Gibson reiterated, asking if Bush would have gone to war if it were determined that there were no WMD. Bush responded, quote, "Oh, I see what you're saying. You know, that's an interesting question. That is a do-over that I can't do. It's hard for me to speculate." Close quote. Reporting on the interview, the Washington Post credited Bush's new candor and said he'd admitted errors and regrets in several areas. But, like Gibson and several other outlets, the Post took no notice of Bush's false claim that Saddam Hussein refused to allow inspectors into Iraq. Weapons inspectors were in Iraq for months when they were withdrawn days before the U.S. attack. Nevertheless, Bush's lie, which he has been telling since July of 2003, has received almost no media coverage. As Bush's failures and deceptions earn him ever lower approval ratings from the public, the media seem unable to constrain themselves from vain attempts to fashion a silk purse from a sow's ear.
Well, George W. Bush still has a friend in Fox News Channel's Chris Wallace. At a recent screening of the film Frost Nixon, Wallace went out of his way to defend the soon-to-be ex-president. Salon's War Room blog described how Wallace took exception to a reference to some unnamed young people's belief that Bush's crimes were worse than Richard Nixon's. Wallace declared that this, quote, "trivializes Nixon's crimes and completely misrepresents what George W. Bush did. Whatever George W. Bush did was after the savage attack of 9/11, in which 3,000 Americans were killed. It was done in service of trying to protect this country. I'm not saying that you have to agree with everything he did, but it was all done in the service of trying to protect this country and keep us safe. And the fact is that we sit here so comfortably, and the country has not been attacked again since 9/11, close quote. Well, that's very stirring. Of course, Richard Nixon, too, would have argued that everything he did was in the service of trying to protect America from its enemies. And the enemies the U.S. faced then were much better armed than the one it faces now, and they never attacked us. So, by Chris Wallace's logic, breaking into the Watergate and secretly taping phone calls must have worked.
And finally, on November 23rd, the New York Times Week in Review section launched an op-ed series called Transitions, in which it promised to provide, quote, a series of op-ed articles by experts on the most formidable issues facing the new president, close quote. The first installment on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan featured seven op-eds. Three were by enthusiastic Iraq hawks. One was an important voice in elite foreign policy debate who supported the invasion. Another worked for former top Iraq commander David Petraeus. Those perspectives were balanced, so to speak, by a pro-invasion author and a journalist who seems to advocate a rather middle-of-the-road perspective. On November 30th, The Times was back with more transitions, this time on the challenges of the economic crisis, and it did little better. The lineup this time, a former Bush senior official who was later Giuliani's chief economic policy advisor and is currently a fellow at the conservative Hoover Institution, a managing director of Goldman Sachs, co-writing with a historian who penned a scathing review of Paul Krugman's latest book, in which he declared that Krugman was maybe not a real economist because he didn't believe in laissez-faire, George W. Bush's former director of the National Economic Council, who is a current fellow at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute, an FDR scholar, and economist Joseph Stiglitz. Stiglitz pushed some more progressive economic medicine, but it was hardly a balanced crew, not to mention that every single one of them was a white male. Despite slapping the label Transitions on their feature, it seems the Times is more interested in staying firmly planted in the past.
Thanks, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
A 1997 book by Elaine Showalter argued that Gulf War syndrome was a matter of psychosomatic hysteria and not of physical pathology. Her book, Histories, Hysterical Epidemics, and Modern Culture, was well received by the media. David Futrell, writing in the liberal journal Salon, heralded Showalter's book under the headline Making Ourselves Sick, and seemed to agree with her that Gulf War syndrome was rooted in psychological rather than physical causes. Well, Showalter, Futrell, and uncounted other media Gulf War syndrome doubters need to reconsider those views following the release of a November 17th report by the congressionally mandated Research Advisory Committee on Gulf War Veterans Illnesses, which found that Gulf War syndrome is real, caused by toxic materials used by the U.S. military during the 1991 Gulf War, and largely incurable. Joining us to talk about Gulf War syndrome in the media is Paul Sullivan, a Gulf War veteran himself and the executive director of Veterans for Common Sense, a Washington, D.C.-based veterans advocacy group. Paul Sullivan, welcome back to Counterspin.
Thank you, Steve. I'm glad to be on today.
Well, let's begin with the report. What more can you tell us about what the panel found?
This landmark Research Advisory Committee report on Gulf War illnesses is very important. Not only did it say that Gulf War illnesses are real and that the illnesses are caused by toxic exposures during the war, the report called for more research to better understand the exposures and more research for treatments to help our veterans get better. But there's one thing, Steve, that the press missed in all the reporting, and that's the fact that the Department of Veterans Affairs intentionally interfered with the scientific process in order to exclude scientific findings that linked Gulf War illnesses to the war.
Well, tell us a little more about that.
Well, here's what happened, Steve. In 1998, I was working on a bill called the Persian Gulf Veterans Act, and that law required the Department of Veterans Affairs, VA, to contract with the Institute of Medicine, the IOM, and they were to review scientific research about toxic exposures such as those in the Gulf War, oil well fires, depleted uranium, experimental pills, experimental anthrax vaccines, and low levels of chemical warfare agents. The law that Congress passed specifically required VA and IOM to investigate and review human research and animal research. However, VA cooked the book. And what can only be seen as criminal activity, VA excluded the congressional requirement of reviewing animal studies. And here's what happened as a result. There are studies actually done by the military that link depleted uranium with birth defects in laboratory animals. There are military studies that link depleted uranium exposure with cancers in laboratory animals. If the Institute of Medicine had been able to review those studies under their contract and then report back to VA and Congress that, in fact, DU, depleted uranium, is related to birth defects and cancers, that could have opened up the door for medical treatment and benefits for hundreds of thousands of Gulf War veterans still suffering.
Much, much earlier. Well, obviously, this new study, this new report is going to change things, but it's been a long road to legitimacy for vets suffering from the array of illnesses caused by toxic military materials. Tell us about that early fight back in the 90s when veterans first started making complaints and how the media treated the story.
The media was a mixed bag in covering Gulf War illnesses. There were a few reporters such as Denny Williams with the Hartford Courant and Dave Parks with the Birmingham News and Norm Brewer and John Hanchett with USA Today who deserve medals for heroism for investigative reporting. One who came along later was Phil Sheehan at the New York Times, and there were a few others, and I'm sorry if I can't remember them all. However, the national television networks and the cable news, they pretty much flunked when it came to reporting Gulf War illnesses. Here's why they flunked. In their rush to do short stories on breaking news, the major networks relied on $300 million in public relations efforts and spending by the Pentagon. That's right. The military and VA spent $300 million on public relations to say that Gulf War illnesses isn't real. That's why there were books like Showalter's and other, you know, quacks like Sally Satel, a psychiatrist, who say that Gulf War illnesses aren't real. So what we had early on was a few reporters doing a very good job investigating, while most reporters, unfortunately, did what we call the rip and read. They looked at the Pentagon press release. They said, oh, there's nothing there. They read that on the air, and they walked away without giving the issue much further thought.
Well, considering the long-term media resistance to the Gulf War Syndrome story, you might think that journalists would be rushing to make amends now that a definitive report has been issued. But as Tim Rutten wrote in the Los Angeles Times on November 19th, it was shocking that the report, quote, failed to find a place. This new report, according to Rutten, quote, failed to find a place on the front page of a single major newspaper, close quote. You've mentioned the recent coverage in one aspect. Tell us about your overall reaction to the recent coverage.
Well, I agree with the LA Times report in general terms that the press essentially missed this huge story that Gulf War illnesses are real. They're caused by toxic exposures, and that the administration, the Department of Veterans Affairs and the Department of Defense, intentionally concealed this problem from the veterans and from the public. I will give a note of exception. Denny Williams, who wrote for the Hartford Courant, did write a follow-up story, very detailed. He gets another A for trying to write a good story. Unfortunately, his story was posted online at truthout.org. There was one media outlet that did get a full A, and they deserve accolades, and that's the PBS NewsHour. They brought on Jim Binns, the chairman of the Gulf War Research Advisory Committee, and they had him on for about 10 minutes live for their evening newscast where he described the problem with Gulf War illnesses. So the NewsHour, in my book, they're heroes on covering this accurately. I'm disappointed that most of the other press missed it. The Associated Press, I want to give them a little bit of credit. In the last few days, the Associated Press has started to come out with a few stories at the local level talking about how Gulf War veterans feel vindicated, that the science and the politicians are now supporting that they, in fact, are ill.
Well, we just have a minute left, Paul, but what is Veterans for Common Sense going to be doing with this story now? I suppose you'll be pushing for more research and treatment. Will you also be pushing for more coverage?
Yes, we are. We're trying to get more reporters to cover the issue of Gulf War illnesses. We're also right now in Washington on Capitol Hill meeting with senators and congressmen and their staff, and we're calling for more research to better understand Gulf War illness, more research to understand and find treatments for Gulf War illnesses, and we want to make sure that the incompetent and malicious VA and military employees who blocked the treatment and research are held accountable. And we want to make sure this fiasco doesn't happen again. That's why today the Institute of Medicine released another report on brain damage. And they're finding that hundreds of thousands of Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans who were near roadside bomb blasts are going to be suffering lifelong debilitating illnesses.
Well, more press coverage couldn't help but bolster your efforts. We've been speaking with Paul Sullivan, the director of Veterans for Common Sense and a veteran of the 1991 Gulf War. You can reach the group's website at veteransforcommonsense.org. Paul Sullivan, thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you very much, and I hope that all of the 700,000 Gulf War veterans who need care get it, and all of the 2 million Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans get it, and that we learn from the mistakes of the past. Thanks very much, Steve.
The elite press corps have been largely cheering Barack Obama's early appointments, folks like Rahm Emanuel as chief of staff and Larry Summers to head the National Economic Council have been heralded in the media. But the question is why? To hear them tell it, Obama's selections show that he is, as the New York Times' David Sanger wrote, planning to govern from the center right of his party, surrounding himself with pragmatists rather than ideologues. What is it about these people, many of them well-known quantities, that leads media to declare them non-ideological? And what presumptions are hidden in terms like pragmatic, so often used to describe them? Here to talk about what media's love for the non-ideological center says about them is FAIRS activism director and co-host of this very show, Peter Hart. Welcome, Peter.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this pragmatist's not ideologues trope is really everywhere. We hear those specifically same words like it's a slogan. We can talk about what sorts of things these pundits are actually endorsing, but first of all, I mean, what do journalists think they're saying when they say that? What does it even mean to be non-ideological?
Well, you have to do a little bit of work to figure out what they mean by it. The default political preference of the corporate media is a kind of corporate centrism. So in the case of Obama, they're either cheering moves that he's made that hew close to that political line, or they're pushing him to get closer to that line, in a sense pushing him to move right. And you understand that, and then you read the coverage understanding that, and it's kind of revealing. There's this Time Magazine article by Karen Tumulty where she's talking about, as you mentioned, Rahm Emanuel, Obama's soon-to-be chief of staff. And they said Rahm Emanuel is not an ideologue. He's a partisan, and he's non-ideological because, and this is their evidence that he's non-ideological, he helped push through welfare reform, the crime bill, and NAFTA. These are positions that are not ideological. And that, I think, is a really crystal clear example of where the media is coming from. These are political positions, but they're in this bubble in the middle of the media's political spectrum where they are not political positions. In the case of pushing Obama further to the right, USA Today had this editorial recently where they said that Obama has been encouraging so far, but they encouraged him to go a bit further. Don't touch NAFTA. Don't pass card check legislation that would benefit the labor movement. And discard the idea of a windfall profit tax on big oil. So these are, again, political positions, but to the media, they're not. They're just common sense.
It's fascinating just at the level of the language because, of course, to label someone ideological is to dismiss them as merely grinding an axe. But if you declare them non-ideological, then even when they do things that, of course, stem from a particular political philosophy and, of course, benefit certain groups over others, the setup then is that critics are not permitted to say, hey, you're benefiting corporations over labor. You're pro-corporate because, well, they're non-ideological. So it's almost as if you can't hold them to any standard according to how their policies affect people.
Yeah, you look at the economic team and they all come from a sort of Reubenite wing of the Democratic Party and they all have a very coherent ideology and they practiced it through the 90s and beyond. But to hear the media tell it now, they don't have one, with a few exceptions. I think the New York Times had an editorial where they were questioning whether Summers has explained himself clearly enough, whether he's owned up to his record. Time Magazine, just to give you a kind of jarring example, they had a piece where they said that Summers' position was going to be akin to Henry Kissinger's position in foreign policy. And they mean this as a compliment. This is to say that he's going to have that kind of power and that kind of sway over whatever the Obama administration decides to do.
Well, the treatment of Larry Summers has bordered on the bizarre because media seem to have really a quite different idea of his record than history would show. For example, his role in the mortgage crisis.
Yeah, and you know, the record has been explained. I think if you read enough, you'll find stories
right,
where, you know, I think the New York Times had a 3,000-word piece about the attempts to regulate the derivatives market. And you read deeply into that and you find out that, oh, Larry Summers was the chief deputy sent out to beat back regulation. So if we're looking at this big picture, there were people who were responsible for making sure that these markets were not regulated. And Larry Summers was at the center of this. To the media, though, that was not a political position to take at the time. It was just the thing to do. The market was going to rule, and it did. And I think Summers is basically paying no price in the media or elsewhere outside of a couple of exceptional pieces that say, shouldn't this guy have more to explain to the American public?
Media simply seem to see it as their role to push what they call bipartisanship, but it always seems to go in one direction. It's almost as if for the elite media, the best thing a Democrat can do is to take on Republican ideas and be friendly to Republicans. It's almost as if we've lost the idea of oppositional politics.
Well, they have this quota, it seems like, some of the pundits, for how many Republicans he should have in his cabinet. And so far, he hasn't reached that. They like the idea of Robert Gates being the defense secretary, but he needs to do a little bit more under this formulation. And I think it's coloring the way we're looking at, for example, the Iraq War. There was a point during the Democratic nomination where the media saw Obama shifting away from his 16-month timeline for withdrawing most combat troops. The media were very excited about this, and Obama actually had a second press conference to say, no, to be clear, I'm keeping my position the way it it was. And we're going through that again now. And I think the fact that there are advisors around him who have not supported the withdrawal in the past, there is a sense in the media, and it's almost a giddiness, that we're there again and Obama is going to wisely decide that his position during the Democratic primaries was one that you take just because you want to win a Democratic nomination. Now that you're president, you govern responsibly and you withdraw that pledge to withdraw U.S. troops. That seems to be the default media interpretation right now, again, with a couple of exceptions, but very few.
It seems to really throw into relief some just the fundamentally anti-democratic attitude of so much elite media because, for example, NAFTA, it's fairly easy to show that many people supported Obama precisely because he pledged to reopen NAFTA, and NAFTA is widely unpopular in this country. So isn't it just anti-democratic for journalists to essentially be saying, oh, who cares about the people who voted for you? Now you're in, it's us, really, that you should be satisfying.
It's the old idea that there are some flip-flops you should make, and in the media, I think, universe, Iraq and economy are two issues where Obama should absolutely change his position. On NAFTA, he softened somewhat again, remember, during the primaries, and the media were overwhelmingly positive toward this. So if Barack Obama wants to be the president of the punditocracy, he knows what positions to take, and the pundits will cheer. At this point, they're cheering, I think, no matter what, because they see Obama shifting positions either whether or not he's really doing it is, I think, a matter of argument. But they see Obama as taking these more, quote-unquote, responsible positions on these issues, and they love it. The voters, if they get a chance to weigh in, might feel differently. But I think on the economy, and especially on the Iraq war, if Obama really is deciding that his pledge to withdraw combat troops doesn't mean anything, that would seem to be a serious breach, but it's one that the media will welcome.
Thanks very much for joining us. We've been speaking with Peter Hart. He's the activism director at FAIR and, of course, the co-host of Counterspin. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the National Media Watch Group, based in New York. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.